Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, we're joined by a couple of political experts to talk about scandals. They can grab headlines, but what damage do they cause when it comes to the public's faith in government? And is there anything that can be done to stop them from happening? Also, Illinois prosecutors are required to publicly release reports about fatal police shootings, but some stay silent. We'll hear what an investigation has learned. Several members of the LGBTQ community say they're worried about what another Trump administration could mean for them. Meanwhile, ag groups are concerned about tough talk on trade. An Illinois college offers students a chance to appreciate art by taking it back to their apartment or dorm. And a different work of art, the molded plastic models, known as Moldorama, owned by an Illinois family. A museum is putting a spotlight on those memorable souvenirs. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This week on Statewide, we're talking political scandals, specifically a new podcast from Boise State Public Radio. It's called Scandalized, and it features two political scientists, Charlie Hunt and Jackie Cutler, who provide the history of these events and what they can teach us. They join me now. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Great to join you.
So let me start by asking, and Charlie, I'll go to you first. What made you decide to focus on this topic?
Well, Jackie and I like to meet occasionally for a happy hour beer. And, because we're both political scientists, what we tend to talk about is not sort of classic celebrity gossip, but what we call sort of the nerd version of celebrity gossip, which for us is political scandals. Whether it's something local where we are in Idaho, or something, from the semi-recent past, Illinois Governor Blagojevich, who I'm sure we'll get into. He's featured in one of our episodes. But, we like to sort of dissect those a little bit and then sort of try to break them down through the lens of political science, which is kind of the lens through which Jackie and I think, see the world of politics a lot of the time to try and understand how these things actually unfold.
Yeah, Jackie, there's coverage of scandals, sort of National Enquirer type of coverage, and then there's sort of dissecting these and taking a closer look at what's really going on. Is that what you're hoping to accomplish with the podcast?
That's exactly right. We wanted to honestly revisit some of these scandals that maybe got a lot of attention at the time, but some of which kind of didn't get a lot of attention. So bring attention to them again and really dive into them and use them to understand kind of where we are today in our politics, as well as bring in this understanding from political science research to try to dissect what happened, why did this happen, and what were the outcomes, and both kind of immediate, perhaps for the actors, but also maybe more broadly. So trying to use some of our areas of research to better understand what happened in these scandals.
Was mentioned Rod Blagojevich, and not only is he part of this podcast, he was the first episode of the podcast, so he holds that number one spot there, and it's somebody that most people here in Illinois know quite well. But Jackie, was there a reason why he was chosen to go first, why you decided to go through this this scandal right off the bat?
A great question. Honestly, we struggled a little bit to decide which scandals to cover in this first season because there are so many that we thought were really interesting. But honestly, I don't think it was much of a challenge to decide to start with Blagojevich. It's just such a fascinating sort of corruption that maybe a lot of people remembered. But he's also such an interesting personality that we just felt like it was this really great starting point.
Charlie Blagojevich, I covered him right up front because I was at the Capitol at the time for Illinois Public Radio. His election, actually even before that, when he was a state lawmaker and congressman, all the way through his impeachment, his trial, his removal from office. I'm always interested in what people outside of Illinois think about him, people that didn't follow him as closely on a day-to-day basis. So, Charlie, what do you think of Blagojevich once you've read through everything and rehashed it all?
This was something that really broke through nationally in the wake of the 2008 presidential election, when a lot of people were already paying attention to national politics, especially because the Senate seat that he was, selling was Barack Obama's Senate seat. So this was not something that was going to stay in Illinois. And I think to Jackie's point, the fact that he's such a character, I think Jackie and I have learned a lot about storytelling through doing this rather than just sort of writing academic papers. And I mean, great characters make for great stories. And so I think that's part of why he really broke through. And, you know, he carried this through even after he was caught. He was on the Celebrity Apprentice. He ended up getting pardoned by Donald Trump. But I think there are a lot of elements of the story that, to Jackie's point earlier, that we were sort of able to investigate some of the gray areas, right? That there was a lot of things that, you know, the selling of the Senate seat was the main thing that people might know Blagojevich for, but there was all this kind of other money-related, embezzling and activity like this around Tony Rezko and other folks that really ended up leading the FBI to Blagojevich and to this eventual charge. Usually, with these kinds of cases, there's all kinds of stuff going on under the surface. And so, Jackie and I learned a lot about Blagojevich, frankly, that we did not know already, and that made the story, frankly, even more scandalous than we had originally thought.
And Jackie, one of the things that comes up with a lot of these people caught up in political scandals, I've found, is that there is some remorse at some point. Blagojevich, I've never heard one word of remorse from him. And does that make him a little bit different?
That is something that we spend some time on in almost every episode, is talking about the response of the actors involved. And you're right, we have some actors like former governor, South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, who infamously went missing, who pretty quickly is like, yeah, I messed up. Like, I mean, you know, a very different response than what we get from Blagojevich, who continued to fight. And so it's really interesting to see some similarities, where some take a very similar approach as Blagojevich, and other actors are, if not immediately, at some point expressing more remorse, apologizing. And so we do have kind of different responses from these actors.
Mentioned Mark Sanford, for example. This was, a romantic, I guess you want to call it, scandal that occurred there in South Carolina. Ours are different here in Illinois. They tend to be about power. They tend to be about money most of the time. Do you see that is the case, that is there other types of scandals out there, and do they fall into these certain categories?
Yeah, I mean, when I think, we opened that episode about Blagojevich talking about Chicago and Illinois and the scandals that tend to go along with that have historically gone along with the state. Of course, George Ryan, who was the governor before Blagojevich, also had his own series of issues related to money. When you're talking about state government, there is a lot of money involved. There's a lot of policy making that happens in the legislature. These budgets can get pretty big. And I think in a lot of cases, it creates maybe an incentive for some self-interested folks to try to get in on it, to try to see what piece of the pie they can get. And then it's just a matter of sort of how bold are you willing to be? I'm originally from Rhode Island, and we have our own set of scandalous politicians from when I was growing up looking to get their piece of the pie as well, especially in some of these big older cities. I think there's basically a lot of money at stake, and this can bring in certain types of folks as well.
Yeah, I think, Jackie, when it comes to these scandals, quite often, what I found from them at least is people already have a distrust of government, and it adds to that. But I always point out to folks that, not everybody that's in government is corrupt. And a lot of people, in fact, I'd say the vast, vast majority go into it for the right reasons. But sometimes people are a bit weak.
You're exactly right. And that's something we wanted to also examine throughout this podcast, is the damage that these scandals can do, but also the positive, things that we can take from it, the people who help report on it, uncover it, the people who helped, whether it was through impeachment hearings or other processes, investigate what happened and try to make things right. And all the kind of other hardworking people who are doing their daily work throughout this. So we're trying to kind of balance this, right? Like, yes, these are terrible things that happened that may be very damaging, while at the same time, here's where we can have confidence in our government, in our political system. So, we're trying to kind of walk this balance, but it is these types of scandals can be incredibly damaging for people's trust. As you know, we already, many individuals have pretty low trust in government. So when something like this happens, it can be damaging long term.
And I'll just add, Sean, that I think, you know, a lot of voters aren't primed to give politicians the benefit of the doubt. And I think Jackie and I both completely understand why that is. On the other hand, one thing I think we learned in a lot of these scandals is that a lot of these are very human mistakes. I mean, I think a lot of the Blagojevich stuff can feel, for example, kind of larger than life. Like, I don't get a lot of opportunities to sell U.S. Senate seats in my day-to-day life. But some of these other ones, you know, when we talk about, we do a couple episodes about politicians maybe bending the truth or lying, you know, humans lie. Everybody lies and bends the truth from time to time. And there were some of these scandals that we covered where I was thinking, you know, I could see myself potentially getting caught up in that a little bit, especially, like we said, when things like money or power or reputation are at stake, it can make people do things maybe they wouldn't normally do in real life. And so we did try to investigate the human side of this as well.
Well, then you have people like Donald Trump, who certainly has been caught up in his own scandals through the years, and yet he's been an outlier on a lot of this. People still seem to like him. Heck, he won the popular vote just a few weeks ago. So he's not sunk by these types of this negative publicity, these scandals that come about. So is he just different than other politicians, or are we hitting a point where maybe people view them differently?
I mean, I think there are a couple of things going on here. One is that with Trump, you know, we've been with him in his sort of political life for, you know, going on a decade now, and everyone is used to this, right? You know, it's sort of human nature that when we are presented with something enough times, we become used to it, and we kind of acclimate to that environment. So I think that's one part of this. The other part is that, you know, a topic we explore, a political science topic we explore in some of these episodes is one called negative partisanship, where, you know, voters more and more, as we become more polarized as a country, we tend to become driven more and more by how much we dislike the other side or dislike the other party, more so than sort of warm feelings we have for our own side. And so that can make us sort of sweep aside some of the bad things maybe our own party does or the politicians that we like do in favor of this ultimate goal of winning and beating the other side. And that polarization can really exacerbate, I think, a lot of our, you know, the voters' reactions to some of these scandals and can kind of numb us to some of the more outrageous stuff that politicians can do. But as we're seeing in these past few weeks, you know, with some of these cabinet nominations, even Trump is not immune to all of this, right? He is not getting everybody he wants for his cabinet, in part due to some of their own political scandals, right? And so, you know, he's often called like Teflon Don, like nothing can stick to him and everything bounces off him. But I think even for him, there are limits.
Yeah, Jackie, would you agree with that or anything you want to add about Donald Trump and how his scandals don't necessarily seem to derail his political career, maybe even at times have helped him?
I think that's right. And how using some of the kind of that negative partisanship that Charlie was talking about, that partisan animosity to kind of fuel and talk about the witch hunts, for example, right? And we see some of the other individuals we talk about throughout this podcast take similar sorts of approaches there. One thing we purposely did not focus an episode directly on Donald Trump in our first season. And yet I think we talk about Trump in almost every single episode, whether he's indirectly connected to the actors involved or he pardons them or in one way or another, he just routinely comes up. And I think that, I mean, we'll continue to have plenty of material for future seasons.
When it comes to government and the legal system, there have been a lot of safeguards put in place, usually based on things that have occurred, maybe more reactive than proactive, but still to try to stop a lot of this behavior from occurring, and yet they still continue to happen. I mean, there's no way, I guess, to weed out people who are intent on either wrongdoing or something that comes up that, like we mentioned, is a scandal.
There are plenty of opportunities for bad actors or actors with bad intentions to still be able to carry out some of these actions. As Charlie noted, some of these individuals perhaps didn't necessarily mean for it to happen the way it did or to get as involved others, I think there was much more intention and knowing fully what they were doing. I think in these cases, right, we still see whether it's personal or professional ramifications, there was some sort of negative outcomes for the individuals involved. I think what's interesting to consider is, what do we not know? Like, these are cases where we had extensive investigations in one way or another through the systems we have in process. We don't believe that these types of issues are widespread in general across the country. And yet we do know, especially at the local level, that there are opportunities, especially for some of these financial scandals and misuse of public funds, something that it continues to be something really important to focus on.
Charlie, I guess we're just going to have to live with political scandals and clean up when they happen. Is that the way to look at it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's part of life. It's part of our politics. And I think, you know, to Jackie's point earlier, it's, you know, part of what we see our job as in making this podcast is maybe educating the public a little bit in terms of what's normal and what's not. What is, you know, something truly out there that doesn't happen a whole lot, like selling Senate seats or things like that, versus what are some more run-of-the-mill things that we have ways of dealing with, you know, that either through financial audits for some of this financial stuff, through media coverage, of course, that we can sort of keep tabs on and make sure it doesn't become the way of doing business. I mean, one interesting thing about Blagojevich that we sort of uncovered is a lot of the discussion, you know, he, to your point earlier, Sean, he didn't seem to think he was doing anything wrong, right? Or at least that's what he maintains, right? That this is just, it's that business and politics are the same thing, that this is all interchangeable. And I think it's sort of up to us, both on the academic side, the media side, and among voters, to be able to try to separate what is truly out there from what is more run of the mill, so that we can sort of protect ourselves against some of the worst excesses of these scandals and not sort of lump them all in the same basket.
We've been talking with two political scientists, Charlie Hunt and Jackie Kettler, and they are producing a new podcast from Boise State Public Radio. It's called Scandalized, and it looks at political scandals. We have a link to it on our show page, including the first episode, which focuses on former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thanks, Sean.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois law requires transparency when people die at the hands of police officers, but many of those cases stay in the dark. In a joint investigation from Illinois Public Media and the Invisible Institute, Farrah Anderson and Chris Weber explain what happens when prosecutors stay silent on police killings. And a note for listeners, the story contains descriptions of violence and sounds of gunshots.
In 2023, Joliet police shot and killed Jamal Smith. Officers Eric Gutierrez and Christopher McClinton arrived at the Lois Place apartments around 4:50 a.m. to investigate a domestic incident. In body camera footage released last year, Smith fires his gun outside the apartment building. Gutierrez and McClinton shot Smith, hitting him in the back of the neck and his leg. Four months later, he died at a Cook County hospital. In a one-sentence email sent to investigators over 250 days later, the Will County State's Attorney's Office said it would not file charges against the officers, but did not explain why. The email was released only after a Freedom of Information Act request. Illinois law requires law enforcement agencies to publicly release a report if no charges are brought against the officers involved in a shooting. Every county in the state files these required reports after police shootings, but of the 15 largest counties, three of them, Will, Madison, and St. Clair, regularly fail to do so. Chris Weber, a reporting fellow with Invisible Institute, spent a year investigating police shootings in Northeast Illinois' Will County, trying to understand why the county was failing to publish these reports. He's going to walk us through the process and what he found.
The killing of Jamal Smith really caught my attention, and I wanted to find out, like so many others, what happened and why weren't the officers charged? Those are the questions these reports are supposed to answer for families, friends, and journalists. But this inconsistency with reporting isn't just because of the agencies that are supposed to publish them. It's also because of the way the law is written. Lauren Jones is a lawyer with Impact for Equity, a nonprofit law firm in Chicago. She says the language leaves a lot up to interpretation by law enforcement, and that has resulted in a patchwork system across the state.
There is sort of a dearth here and a gap for clarity and timeliness and transparency about officer-related deaths for the public.
The amount of information an Illinois resident can expect to receive and how long they can expect to wait for it varies wildly by county. And when activists and families request the reports to see why charges weren't filed against the involved officers, they're often denied. Police say they can't share information about ongoing investigations.
Trista Graves Brown is a Joliet activist and resident, and she was a friend of Jamal Smith. She says these investigations can last years, leaving people like her in the dark about what actually happened in the shootings.
But how long is the investigation? A year? 2 years? How long is it that you can never show the truth? How long is it that they gotta wait?
If an officer is being cleared for their fatal shooting or involvement with an in-custody death, activists like Graves Brown say members of the public deserve an explanation.
They should never have a problem exposing who did it, why they did it, how they did it, and because they did it. If you have nothing to hide, then you check nothing to expose. Shouldn't have a problem with that.
The Illinois Attorney General's office and state lawmakers did not respond to requests for comment.
Farrah Anderson and Chris Weber reporting. That story produced in partnership with the nonprofit newsroom Invisible Institute and co-reported by Sam Stecklow. An effort to give Springfield voters the power to recall the Sangamon County Sheriff was denied this week. The Democratic County Board member Sam Canman's resolution would put a question on the April ballot asking voters if they want the power of recall. Canman says it's a critical reform in light of Sonya Massey's killing last summer. Massey was an unarmed black woman shot by a former sheriff's deputy, Sean Grayson. Then-Sheriff Jack Campbell, who oversaw Grayson's hiring, stepped down shortly after. A lot of the LGBTQ community is anxious about what Donald Trump's second term could mean for them. Joe Deacon checked in with some Peoria residents to hear how they're feeling.
Honestly, I'm a bit worried. I'm not worried that more people will be hateful towards us. I'm worried that the people that are already hateful towards us are going to be emboldened.
That's Zoe Carter, the executive director of the Pekin-based Rural Equality Project. As a transgender woman, she notes that trans people were specifically targeted in a number of Trump campaign ads. She says while the election result came as a shock, it's also become a call to action.
2025, they're on track to possibly hitting like 1,000 anti-trans bills. And so there's a lot of really just like, what are we going to do moving forward? A lot of the community has kind of gotten together and realized that just sitting around isn't going to get us anywhere. We've got to kind of get together as a community, band together, and figure out a way we're going to be moving forward.
Central Illinois Friends is a healthcare provider for many LGBTQ people. Executive Director Derek Kimmler says he was not stunned by Trump's victory.
From where I sit in terms of where I come from and the folks that we serve and what I hear and the rhetoric I see, I'm not surprised that this happened. However, I am hurt that it happened, and I'm hurt because I've been listening to him, and I think a lot of people haven't been. I think there's been a lot of people that have rightfully so sheltered themselves from knowing what his policies are and knowing what his stances are, and I haven't. Central Illinois Friends has been preparing for quite some time now for a Trump second term.
Kimmler says those initial preparations have focused on protecting the organization.
We know how his rhetoric can really spike action in our communities. So we've upped security big time. We also have a plan B just in case something does happen to our facility or if we are, for whatever reason, targeted. We've also financially been preparing to be able to try and combat any pulled funding that will go against LGBTQ plus healthcare.
River Russell, who serves as an at-large board member for Peoria Proud, says that possibility of reduced access to healthcare is a major issue.
Thankfully, as a transgender man who is able to move to Illinois, I have access to safe and affordable healthcare, but I'm from Georgia, and I started my transition when I was in Minnesota. When I was in Minnesota, I had to drive 2.5 hours to get access to my hormones and then another 4 hours to get to a pharmacy to pick them up. I have found solitude and peace and access in Peoria, but it's not a national thing. People shouldn't have to leave their homes to be able to access this.
Cassie Lucchese is the president of Peoria Proud. She says LGBTQ individuals are uncertain about a lot of things right now.
They're worried that they're not going to be able to access healthcare, like Ripper said. Women are worried that their rights are going to be taken away. We're worried that our marriages aren't going to be recognized in states that aren't states like Illinois. And so then what comes with that, right? What protections do you have? Do you have the access and the ability and the privilege to be able to afford a lawyer to get a power of attorney and a living will drawn up and things like that?
Brian C. Johnson is the CEO of the statewide LGBTQ civil rights organization Equality Illinois. He says, first and foremost, they will work to shore up state protections regarding data privacy and access to gender-affirming care.
You know, on top of that, we're also looking, what are the ways that we could still push Illinois to be even more affirming of its LGBTQ plus people, keep the LGBTQ plus community even more safe from over-criminalization, from the reach of an anti-equality federal government? That's going to take some time, but we're keeping an eye on that.
Johnson says national and state-based advocacy groups plan to convene in the coming weeks. In the long run, he says the biggest concerns are the federal judiciary and how to best protect the rights of LGBTQ individuals. I'm Joe Deacon.
Chicago's southeast side is home to that city's largest industrial corridor. In recent years, environmental justice activists have been successfully pushing back on new industrial development. But now their tactics are under threat, just as President Trump prepares to settle back into the White House. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco has the story.
Olga Bautista and her neighbors scored a major win last year. They stopped a huge metal shredding operation from setting up shop in Chicago's Southeast Side neighborhood.
We filed a civil rights complaint to HUD while Trump was in office, and it was settled once Biden was in office.
Bautista is the executive director of the Southeast Environmental Task Force. It's an environmental justice organization that came together to protect the majority Black and Latino neighborhood already besieged by heavy industry from more pollution. To do it, they got creative. They used the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
What the Civil Rights Act really does, Title VI, is it prohibits the discrimination on the base of race, religion, and other protected classes in any programs where federal money is spent.
That's Robert Weinstock. He directs the Environmental Advocacy Center at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. He also represented groups on the Southeast Side in their complaint to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. They argued that Illinois' permitting program led to outcomes that harmed some racial groups more than others, and that federal officials had to intervene. And then they did.
So we've already seen Illinois EPA sort of change the way that it notifies communities about new actions in environmental justice areas, and we're in the midst of a number of other reform efforts.
But despite the success in Chicago, the tactic is increasingly under fire. Earlier this year, a federal judge sided with the state of Louisiana after it argued that the Civil Rights Act couldn't be used to fight environmental justice claims in that state. Now, attorneys general in nearly 24 other red states want those same limitations to the Civil Rights Act.
23 Republican attorneys general filed a petition with US EPA to roll back those rules entirely and to get rid of its disparate impact enforcement of the Civil Rights Act entirely.
Weinstock said that what the Biden administration does over the next 2 months will set the stage for the future of the EPA. And according to environmental advocates, there's no sugarcoating it. Hard times are ahead. Gino Rodriguez is a longtime Southeast Side resident and the Midwest Environmental Health Director for the Natural Resources Defense Council.
We're going to see weakened air quality standards and water protections. The EPA is going to be gutted. Whole departments, probably the Environmental Justice Department, will go away.
During President Trump's first term, his administration rolled back nearly 100 environmental protections. This second time around, Trump has promised more of the same. He's also vowed to roll back Biden's federal funding for clean energy projects. Hundreds of millions of those dollars have already made their way to Illinois.
It's easy to give up, but I'm determined, and I know a lot of environmental justice communities are determined to not lose that momentum.
Rodriguez said that going forward, they will have to lean on local leaders like never before.
We're a blue state. We're a blue city. We're a blue county. And so, like, let's be this gold star example of how we can protect environmental justice communities.
In the meantime, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker has said he's working to safeguard statewide environmental and other protections. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco, WBEZ News.
This coverage made possible through a partnership between WBEZ and GRIST, a nonprofit independent media organization dedicated to telling stories of climate solutions and a just future. College students often use posters to help spruce up their dorms or apartments. At the University of Chicago, they get in line early for the chance to borrow works by prominent artists for a year. Allison Cuddy has details.
The small courtyard outside the Smart Museum at the University of Chicago is normally an oasis of stately trees and stunning sculptures. On this warm fall Saturday morning, it looks and sounds more like a slumber party. Clusters of students are spread out along a concrete wall, wrapped in blankets, chatting and working on their laptops. Cups of coffee and bags of food are scattered around. Rafaela Grieco Freeman was the very first to arrive. She and the other students spent the night outdoors not as part of orientation, but for a work of art, museum-quality art. Lithographs by Miro and Chagall, prints by Gordon Parks and Jenny Holzer, even a couple of Picassos.
I was like, no way this is real. Like, this is just, somebody's making something up. I'm getting fake news. And it's astonishing to be a part of this and be able to have these, like, priceless, you know, works of art and also, like, pieces of history just in a dorm room.
This annual event is not only real, it's been around since 1958, the brainchild of an alum, Joseph R. Shapiro, an avid collector and co-founder of Chicago's Museum of Contemporary Art. Shapiro thought students would appreciate art if they could live with it, so he gave the university 50 works to start a lending program. The idea was a big hit from the start, and the collection grew. But in the late 1980s, it went dormant. Thanks to a new funder, it was rebooted in 2017 as Art to Live With, now run by the Smart Museum. Vanya Malloy, the Smart's director, thinks it offers students a new view on art and life.
It could be something you look at as you drink your morning coffee every day, and you see it in a different way, and maybe you notice things that you didn't before. So living with a work allows you to have this depth of experience that you wouldn't if you were just scrolling on your phone.
Any student living in campus housing can participate. Lauren Payne, who runs Art to Live With, says they do have to sign a loan agreement to keep the art for the school year.
Accidents definitely happen. You know, sometimes it might fall off the student's wall and the frame might get damaged or a hinge might get slipped. But, you know, there's never any malicious damage or anything that has been taken.
By late afternoon, the sun is beating down. Some students pass the time playing cornhole. Then the first check-in starts.
We're starting right over there.
Economics students Anwar Kul Mohammed and Rudra Patel have been waiting near the head of the line for more than 12 hours. They think they've got a good shot at their picks when the museum opens in the morning. Then Patel learns they'll go in as a group of 15.
Oh my God, bro.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I thought it was a group of like, what?
All right, group one. Everybody's here.
The next morning, they do get what they'd hoped for, an etching by one of the old masters, Francisco de Goya, and a woodblock by Japanese artist Ando Hiroshige, known for his epic landscapes. Even so, Anwar says he's not sure it was worth it.
Sleeping outside, you know, in the cold, it was just terrible. It was the worst night I've had here by far.
However, Isha Mehta did return for a second year. The economics and human rights student dressed to match her choice, a lithograph by pop artist Mel Ramos. She says the program has changed her.
And it did make me more interested in learning more about like the art and going to the Smart Museum exhibits. And it did encourage me to take a specific like art history class last year.
The future of art to live with might be up in the air. Its funding will run out after one more year. But for now, students head home, happily clutching an original artwork to hang in their dorm. For NPR News, I'm Allison Cuddy in Chicago.
More ahead on Statewide. We'll be right back after this. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Illinois plans to tell its history of how thousands traveled through the state fighting for their freedom. Ben Howell reports on what a task force is recommending to chronicle the Underground Railroad in Illinois.
A 2023 law in Illinois established a task force that would start exploring ways that the history of the Underground Railroad in the state could be better commemorated. Both the legislation and the task force were led by State Senator Dave Kaler, who represents parts of Bloomington Normal. At a news conference announcing the task force findings, Kaler acknowledged that despite nationwide efforts, Illinois is committed to teaching its history, the good and the bad.
Across the country, some are tirelessly trying to prevent people from learning about our country's history of racism as well as fearless preservation of Black Americans who fought to escape slavery through the Underground Railroad.
The task force identified over 200 historical sites across the state that could be preserved and made more available to the public that were a part of the railroad. Aside from the obvious connections to the Civil War, like being the home state of President Abraham Lincoln, Kaler wishes for their efforts to highlight the untold stories as well.
Our bipartisan Underground Railroad Task Force aims to uplift the stories that have not been told for decades, some of the bravest Illinoisans who stood up against oppression.
Former professor at Governor State University and task force member Larry McClellan said people around the state were not only cooperative, but they also shared their mission of telling the rest of history.
For those of us that are committed to enlarging this part of Illinois' history, it's a delight to see folks really want to work together.
The task force recommended a state commission to undergo the various projects identifying the historic sites. Moldorama machines have been providing on-demand souvenirs and immediate joy to customers for over 60 years. You may have encountered the space-age-looking vending machines at a zoo or museum. And why go to the gift shop when you can watch and even smell your item being made? The concept is simple. Put your money in and molten plastic is injected into a mold. In a minute, you get a colorful figurine. The very first made their debut at the Seattle World's Fair in 1962, but by the end of the decade, production of the machines shut down. There have been ownership changes through the years, and today the official Moldorama company is owned by the Jones family in suburban Brookfield. An exhibition at the Chicago Museum of Science and Industry is celebrating the souvenir-making nostalgia. Jeff Bonomo with the museum talked with Gary Zydek about it.
Really, the history of these machines is tied to Illinois?
Yeah, the founder actually is from Quincy, Illinois, and it's a funny story. He actually needed a piece for his nativity scene that he had lost and then kind of started making missing pieces for people out of plaster. During World War II, plaster was not allowed to be imported in from Germany. So he had a need, and he realized a way to use injection molding to create pieces for his nativity scenes, and then later found a need and an opportunity to turn it into kind of a souvenir business. So he made these Moldorama machines and later sold the rights to the American Retailers Association that now is known as Aramark, and then they had them throughout the country at souvenir stops, tourist stations, bus stations, and all the likes. But they kind of started here in Quincy, and they kind of still have their headquarters here in Brookfield, Illinois.
Right, I was reading about the transitions over the years. So it starts with this, gets passed on, but then at some point is it like a family in Brookfield bought it?
Yeah, there's two main players in the field of injection molding souvenir machines, and the biggest one is here in Brookfield, Illinois, and they actually acquired the rights recently to the name Moldorama, so that is the name of their company, and then there's another one in the south called Moldomatic. But the Jones family has had the machine since the early 70s, so they've been passing that around down through their generations, and they have about 65 machines in many different states, but they're kind of the heart of them are here in the Chicagoland.
And did I read somewhere no new machines have been produced since the 60s?
That's correct. Those are still the same workhorses that have been around for almost 60 years that they just keep running well at their shops out in the suburbs. And keep finding old machines to use as parts, and just they keep them working, and it's a testament to the machine itself, I guess.
And so just for people listening, I'm sure a lot of people like know the concept, but the Moldorama essentially is like this vending machine that you put in whatever the cost is these days. I'm sure that's changed over the years. And then you can pick whatever type of figure and it makes it right in front of you.
Yeah, that's about right. You put in your money at the machine of your choice. We have about 9 here in the museum, and they're usually themed around the exhibition that they're near. And then 2 large aluminum plates come together, and hot plastic is injected into the mold at 250 degrees. There's actually cold water running through the mold, so it kind of essentially freezes when it hits the aluminum. And then the excess is blown out, and then the molds break apart, and the pusher pushes out your hot souvenir. You take it out of the machine. You're supposed to hold it upside down for a minute. I'm not sure why, but that's just what they tell us. And then you have your souvenir made right before your eyes.
And how would you, since this is radio, how would you describe the smell?
It smells like warm plastic, and that's one of the things most visitors have as far as the memory of the Moldorama here at the museum and other locations is just that warm wax smell. So if you follow your nose around the museum this time of year, you'll find about 9 different machines, 4 of which are in this new Moldorama exhibition.
So what's in the exhibit?
So in the exhibition, we have almost 150 different Moldorama souvenirs from the Jones family from throughout the years throughout the country that have been made. So you can see those, which are really cool to see, including the first one ever done here at the museum, which was a Lincoln head in 1971. And then we have some really cool aluminum molds, which are the pieces that actually take the plastic and create your mold, including one which was rarely run because of the complexity, which is the Colleen Moore's Fairy Castle, which if anyone's been to the museum, they've probably seen the Fairy Castle in real life. So that's down there, which is a real collectible among the Moldorama collectors. Okay. Of course, we have 4 Moldorama machines with all new to MSI molds. And then we have some information about just how the Moldorama is made, the history of plastics, and even some Bakelite, which is kind of the first commercially used plastic from the early 1900s. From our collection and made things a lot more consumer accessible as far as cost and quantity. So we have some artifacts from that, and we have a great photo op for you to take with your first Moldorama.
Jeff Bonomo with the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, and the Moldorama exhibit continues through the end of the year. The feelings among Illinois agricultural groups about potential Trump administration tax and regulatory policies are a lot less ambiguous than they are over trade. On trade, they're hoping that Donald Trump's protectionist policies do not result in an increase in disputes and retaliation, despite a history at odds with that hope. As Charlie Schlinker reports, the Corn Growers Association, the Soybean Association, and the Illinois Farm Bureau all expect favorable tax legislation.
Republicans will hold the House, Senate, and presidency next year. That makes many things easier. The GOP is largely united on an approach to tax policy. Lower taxes are better. Illinois Corn Growers Association Executive Director Rodney Weinzierl says a number of tax credits enacted in Trump's first term will sunset next year, and they expect a new Congress to revive them and the president to sign them.
The changes that were made to the estate tax were very beneficial to agriculture. And there's a number of business tax credits that are associated with depreciation of farm equipment that are really important in helping farmers manage the variability of income that you have in agriculture.
Non-ag tax laws could also help farmers. Soybean farmer Ryan Frieders of Waterman, Illinois, says many family farms have corporate structures, so corporate tax rate reductions could help a lot. Rodney Weinzierl hopes for clarity over the long-contested Waters of the United States rules that farmers say prevents them from farming their own land in their own way.
There's still a lot of concerns on consistency as to how US EPA or the Army Corps is handling that. Seems to be differences.
He says there's been a lot of change around the re-registration of herbicides and the insecticide rule and the Endangered Species Act. He's confident the Trump administration will make choices that favor farmers in that area to make sure the regulations work together and create certainty for agriculture.
Some of the current rules are going to be a little bit, are going to be just one, difficult to understand what compliance looks like and the different mitigation areas that are being proposed add a lot of complexity in trying to meet what the standard's trying to do.
Weinzierl says many of the rules are tied to current ag practices, And those practices vary from region to region, which makes it tough to tell what's legal and what's not.
Just keeping things simple so that people can understand what does it take to be in compliance is a big deal.
Congress has been kicking the can down the road for some time on renewing the federal farm bill, which covers a host of commodity, conservation, trade, and nutrition programs. With the early bandwidth of the Trump administration taken up in confirming cabinet nominees and renewing the Trump tax cuts, almost no one expects a farm bill to pass in 2025. Ag groups all expect a one-year extension to the expired farm bill. Illinois Farm Bureau National Legislative Director Ryan Whitehouse says that still leaves farmers dealing with a 2024 economy through 2018 policy rules. With such a sweeping piece of legislation and no big majorities in either legislative chamber, White House says there are many opportunities for differences. For instance, the House GOP Freedom Caucus doesn't like the inclusion of food assistance or SNAP benefits for lower-income Americans in a traditional farm bill. White House says having Representative G.T. Thompson of Pennsylvania remain chair of the House Ag Committee will help.
We will see, with President Trump being in the White House, if perhaps he can help persuade the Freedom Caucus to come along on some of these bills, on the farm bill specifically, especially when President-elect Trump has talked about how important agriculture is and the farmer is. But it's not a slam dunk. I wouldn't say it's a slam dunk yet.
The three farm groups say they hope the next farm bill will not take away from people in need. Ryan Frieders says it's about more than filling a need. It's about food security.
Keeping that nutrition component is important, and also focuses the USDA on making sure that we're providing a safe, healthy food source for our nation and the world.
If SNAP does become a political football, Rodney Weinzierl of the Corn Growers urges Republican restraint to avoid blowback in a succeeding administration. Outside of SNAP, the number of people affected by the rest of the farm bill is less than 2% of the nation's population. You cut nutrition out of a farm bill, and Weinzierl says you will get no Democratic votes, and it will be hard to get urban votes. SNAP did become part of the presidential campaign for a minute. That's unusual.
What we don't need is having ag policy that kind of gets whipsawed from one side to the other and back, if we turn the farm bill into a partisan effort. So hopefully that doesn't happen to the degree that maybe some people would like to see.
And Weinzierl says until now, the farm bill has been one of the few areas where bipartisanship still prevails.
So it seems like it's different, and hopefully it's not, and that we were able to go back to regular order and get a bipartisan bill.
Another aspect of the farm bill relates to potential impacts from President Trump's protectionist trade stance. Agriculture interests say they hope any Trump administration trade tariffs will not create a need for market facilitation payments to offset lost foreign sales of commodities. If they do, it raises the importance of a safety net for farmers incorporated in the farm bill. Traditionally, the Commodities Credit Corporation has been responsible for making funds available to farmers in times of crisis. Ryan Frieders of the Soybean Association says that is a current sticking point.
There has been some negotiations in using commodity credit fund money for other various programs through the USDA, besides what it was originally intended and designed for. I feel like that would be a bad use of those funds. We need to make sure those funds are kept separate and available for what they were originally intended for.
Frieders also hopes there will be other offsets to tariffs.
There hasn't been any increases in the money spent on like market access program or the foreign market development program in years. And those programs have brought us the customers that we have today.
There is new money for that in the House draft of the bill. President Trump has talked a lot about downsizing government and cutting the federal workforce. Farm groups say agriculture is not a great place to do that. For instance, the crop insurance program is complicated and requires a high degree of expertise to administer. Another example comes from the first Trump administration. The number of complaints and fines against meatpackers for cheating beef, chicken, and pork producers dropped significantly when the agency that investigated those claims was downsized. There may be fewer unintended consequences this time. Rodney Weinzierl says based on the appointments announced so far, he has hope the second Trump administration has a much better idea of what they want to accomplish.
In his first term, there were a lot of people he brought in that really learned on the job instead of kind of knowing when they stepped in the door. And I think that caused some of that problem. So I'm hopeful that he knows what he's getting into. His team understands what they want to get done.
Ryan Frieders says farmers are optimistic by nature because they plant things and expect them to grow in the face of uncertainties like weather, weeds, and insects. They are not afraid of change, even change, in presidential administrations. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being along and join us next week. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.